From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air Weekend. Today,
it's all in the family, that's no lie, even stays that way after we die.
Loudon Wainwright performs some songs about his life and his family. After writing lots of songs about his life and family, he's written a new memoir. It's called Liner Notes. Also, Ken Burns and Lynn Novick talk about their new PBS documentary series, The Vietnam War.
You could take just a collection of a half dozen things from the Vietnam War and just say, aren't they happening now? Mass demonstrations all across the country against the current president, a White House in disarray, obsessed with leaks, a president certain the press is lying about him, big, huge document drops of stolen...
The series describes the war from multiple perspectives and includes interviews with fighters from North Vietnam. And David Bianculli reviews the new Jerry Seinfeld Netflix stand-up comedy special. First News. This is Fresh Air Weekend. I'm Terry Gross. My guest, Loudon Wainwright, seems to have been an imperfect partner, husband, and father, but he's written remarkable songs about family and how we hurt and heal each other only to do it all over again. Now in his new memoir, Liner Notes, he writes in more detail about his life as a husband, father, son, philanderer, and musician. His first wife, Kate McGarrigle, was a singer-songwriter too, and she wrote songs about their relationship from her point of view. Their two children, Rufus and Martha Wainwright, are now well-known singer-songwriters. Loudon had a long-term relationship with another singer-songwriter, Suzzy Roach, and their child, Lucy, also became a singer. The memoir includes lyrics to Loudon's songs, as well as some of the columns written by his late father, who worked for Life magazine from the 1960s through the 80s. Loudon is officially Loudon Wainwright III. His father was Loudon Wainwright Jr. Loudon brought his guitar and is going to perform some songs for us. I've emphasized his more autobiographical songs, but he's also known for his topical songs and for his first and only big hit, the 1972 novelty recording Dead Skunk. Loudon Wainwright, welcome back to Fresh Air. I love your new book. I'm really glad you wrote it. So the book is dedicated, here's the dedication, for the family and all we put us through. That has to be one of the most emotionally complex dedications I've read. It's usually, you know, for the person I love most in life, for my beautiful daughter, for my loving husband, you know. So how did you come up with that as your dedication?
Well, for some time, I've been writing lots of songs about the family. I'm really interested in the dynamics of dysfunctional and otherwise. And my family, like most families, has issues, I guess, to use that word. So, you know, I was just thinking about the dedication, and it came to me, as sometimes these things do. Also, I like the fact that the word put can also be past and present and future. So it's a kind of a historical but ongoing thing.
And the other thing that's interesting to me about the dedication is it's for the family. When you're a part of really like three families with children, you have children with three different women and are a part of three separate families, do you think of it all as one family?
They're different, the three entities or families, but we are, a lot of the time actually, we're all to get thrown together for whatever reason. And then it feels like just one big, is it mishugana? No, that's the wrong word. What's the right word?
Mishpucha.
That's the one. I knew it was an M word. Mishpucha.
You were close. Mishugana is crazy.
Well, that too.
Which is fitting. Okay. Since so much of your book is about family, the family you were born into and the families you helped make, let's start with your song, All in a Family. Do you want to tell us how you wrote it?
Occasionally people ask me to write for a specific thing, a movie or a television show or something like that. And I think, as I recall, there was a television show called Parenthood. Am I right about that?
Yes, I think.
And the word went out to songwriters. They were looking for a song. And I wrote this song, All in a Family, and thought it was great, and they rejected it. So it didn't work out, but it kind of did work out because I like the song a lot.
I like it too. Why don't you play it for us?
Okay.
And I should mention, Loudon Wainwright has brought his guitar.
It's all in the family, that's no lie. Even stays that way after we die. Leaves, branches, twigs on a family tree in the forest can be hard to see. Mother and father are in charge, and a brand new baby will loom large. Brothers, sisters, uncles, aunts. It's a family life, so take a chance. It's a work in progress, can't you see? And the why, wherefore is a mystery. When the family fights, ain't no next door. No one wins in a family war. Then there's that thing it's all made of. Dare we sing that the thing is love? Love heals heartache and familial pain. And what family is not insane?
That's Loudon Wainwright performing in the studio. Thank you for doing that. Let's talk about family. Let's start with the family you were born into. Your father was a columnist for Life magazine in the 60s through the 80s. He wrote a column called The View from Here. You were raised in an affluent suburb of New York. Your father went to prep school. You were sent to prep school. And you felt that part of your job in life was not being him. What parts of him did you especially not want to be?
Wow. Well, he sent me to the same boarding school that he was miserable at. Let's put it that way. We can start with that. He was kind of a depressive fellow, I'm sorry to say. I mean, I think incredibly talented and charming and handsome, and people loved him, and a big, powerful guy. But he suffered from depression and alcoholism also. So, growing up, I watched him try to write and meet deadlines and try to write books and not succeed at that. And he had a kind of tortured existence, at least that's the way I perceived it. So I decided I did not want to be a writer, so I kind of got interested in acting and performing and went to drama school and all that. But then I circled back and started to write songs, so I guess I could run, but I couldn't quite hide.
He had affairs. Some of them were long as well as secret. He drank a lot, like you said. How did your mother find out about the affairs that he was having, especially the one that was like 7 years long?
Well, I don't know. I think, like, certainly from the generation that they were from, I think denial was a way to go. You know, and I think probably my mother knew that he was out and about, but maybe didn't want to know the details or didn't want to face the reality of it. And then, again, both my parents are dead, so there's no way I can check on that. But I think there was denial, and she didn't want to know. And he worked hard at keeping it a secret and then either got caught or confessed or something like that.
Since things weren't great at home, did you want to be at home where things weren't great? Because it sounds like you weren't happy in boarding school. You weren't happy being away.
I wanted to go to high school where there were girls and high school stuff, but I was sent to this boarding school, a place down in Middletown, Delaware, called St. Andrews. I don't know if I would have been any happier had I gone to high school. I wasn't completely miserable either. I mean, I complain a lot about it. I got a pretty great education and started to play in folk bands. And, you know, there were some great things that I did and was in school plays, which was very important for me also. Mm-hmm.
So after you got out of boarding school, you briefly went to college to study drama. You dropped out of college and went to San Francisco. And this was probably, what, 1967?
Yeah.
Summer of Love. Yeah. So did you renounce your privilege when you got to San Francisco? Because to come from a privileged family was considered so bourgeois, and nobody wanted to be bourgeois who was into being a hippie.
Hmm. Well, I knew lots of other kids like me, you know, when we first went out there and lived in a crash pad, as they used to call them, on Frederick Street in the Fillmore District in San Francisco. Some of the other kids were, and I say kids, we were 19 or 20 years old. You know, they had also gone to boarding school. And one of my crash pad mates was Donald Fagen from soon to be a Steely Dan. So, you know, we were middle class or upper middle class kids. And as I recall, that summer was not so much about political activism or social awareness, but it was more like just getting up and having fun and dropping acid. That's what I remember anyway.
Well, you dropped a lot of acid, and you also, for a while, studied Buddhist meditation and spent some time in a monastery, you know, like a Buddhist monastery. How did you realize that actually that path was not for you?
Well, the monastery that I went to, which was in Virginia City, Nevada, was a yoga monastery. I think that for some of us who dabbled in psychedelics or took those drugs, there was a logical turn toward spiritual things. You know, you'd be on an acid trip and you'd be sitting there for 15 hours. So things like the Bhagavad Gita and the I Ching and the Upanishads, I'm probably mispronouncing some of these words, but they were kind of groovy and cool. And, you know, I was in that subset of hippies that was attracted to that Eastern stuff. And I have been, in various parts of my whole life, been attracted to that Eastern stuff.
So the first song that you became famous for was, you know, a comic. It was a novelty song called Dead Skunk in the Middle of the Road. And I'm going to ask you to just play a few bars from that and to tell us the story behind that, because that song had a really big influence on your life.
Okay, here it comes. Crossing the highway late last night, shoulda looked left and shoulda looked right, didn't see the station wagon car. Skunk got squashed and there you are, you got a dead skunk in the middle of the road. Dead skunk in the middle of the road. Dead skunk in the middle of the road, stankin' the high heaven.
Great, thank you for doing that. That's Loudon Wainwright. And I should mention here that Loudon Wainwright has a new memoir, which is called Liner Notes. So that song made you famous. It, I hope, made you a lot of money. And it kind of created expectations that this is the kind of thing you would do. You would write really funny songs. And you've written a lot of really funny songs and really funny topical songs over the years. But you also wanted to head in other, you know, more serious and emotionally complex directions. So what were some of the, like, good things and some of the bad things that resulted from the popularity of that song? Which I think, a song I think you actually wrote after running over a skunk in the middle of the road.
Yeah, yeah. Someone had already killed it, but I ran over it. And and then, you know, said, stankin' to high heaven. And then I went home and wrote that song in about 15 minutes. But I kind of sensed that it might catch on. And it did when I started to perform it. And it was exciting. What a thrill to hear your song on the radio, on the AM radio, what they used to call the AM radio. I don't know what they call it now. But that was fun. And certainly that there was money as a result. I've said it's paid for a lot of child support, Dead Skunk.
Yeah.
But the problem was I became the skunk guy. And when you have it got to something like number 12. And in some parts of the country, it was number one. But you're expected, what's the next funny animal song, you know, about the aardvark or whatever. And that got to be a drag. And I played it for a while, and then I got sick of it. And I put out a record after that that didn't have a novelty song on it or a funny animal song on it anyway. But the people at radio just didn't want to know. I was the skunk guy, and they wanted something along those lines. So I hardly ever do it. But today is special.
Well, today's autobiography day. And you did talk about the song in your book, so I thought it would be
It will be in my obituary. The dead skunk thing will be there.
It will be. It will be. So another really life-changing thing, you met the singer Kate McGarrigle. And she was a backup singer when you met her, when she started writing her own songs and singing with her sister, Anna McGarrigle, and they became popular. You write that you got jealous, that it was, quote, too threatening for your fragile ego. And then after that, you married Suzzy Roach, who also sang with her sisters. And
well, Suzzy and I were never actually married.
Oh, you were never actually married?
No, we lived in sin for 9 years.
And had a daughter together.
Yes, we have a beautiful daughter and named Lucy Wainwright Roach, yes.
So, you know, you were attracted to two really talented singer-songwriters before they became famous.
Yes.
And once they became really recognized, you seemed to find them more threatening. That's the impression I got from the book. I'm sure there's plenty of other complex things that had to do with the end of your relationship, including, as you describe it, you know, your relationships with other women. So how does it feel to you to write about that in the book?
To write about those, about my marriage and my relationship with Suzzy. Actually, I've written all about those big relationships, particularly the ones where there were children
in songs
involved. And how does it feel to write about it? Well, I write about
like
all these
confessing
people in the songs. So, I mean, they're all in the songs. So why not put them in the book? I mean, it's tricky. And it wasn't easy, I think, to write about, you know, my relationship with Kate, the brilliant Kate, who is no longer with us. You know, we fought like crazy, and then we split up, and then we fought for 30 more years after that about the kids.
So, about how to raise them?
Yeah, we disagreed, and, you know, the marriage continued. I think, despite the fact that we, you know, were divorced in 1976. So, whereas in the situation with Suzzy Roach, she's my best friend. I mean, I saw her yesterday, literally. We were hanging out. So, it can go all different kinds of ways. But I write about those people because they're the big important people in my life, along with my parents and grandparents and siblings and kids, certainly.
My guest is singer-songwriter Loudon Wainwright. He's written a new memoir called Liner Notes. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air Weekend.
The Neubauer Family Foundation supports WHYY's Fresh Air and its commitment to sharing ideas and encouraging meaningful conversation. Support for NPR comes from this station and from Inada, creators of the Japanese-made Dreamwave massage chair with shiatsu point detection and 16 programmed massages, including morning and nighttime sessions. Retail dealers nationwide. More at dreamwavechair.com. And from Progressive Insurance, offering its Home Quote Explorer, so shoppers can evaluate options in one place when buying home insurance. Custom quotes and rates are available online. Learn more at progressive.com.
This is Fresh Air Weekend. I'm Terry Gross, back with singer-songwriter Loudon Wainwright, who's known for his topical songs and his autobiographical songs about family. The lyrics to some of his songs are included in his new memoir, Liner Notes. He has a large and complicated family life that he's sung about, and some of his other family members have written songs about him. His family has an unusually high number of singer-songwriters, including his late ex-wife, Kate McGarrigle, their children, Rufus and Martha Wainwright, Loudon's former partner, Suzzy Roach, and their daughter, Lucy Wainwright Roach.
So you married Kate McGarrigle after she was pregnant, quote, due to our hit and miss birth control practices. Did you want to be a father?
I think I had a romanticized idea about it, you know, that, and I thought maybe it would make me more manly or something. But I was woefully unprepared for the reality of it. And consequentially, I mean, I feel like I wasn't really on the ball the way I should have been. I mean, when Rufus was born, my eldest kid, my son, you know, I was in my early 20s, and I was grappling with my career, and I was traveling, and I was messing up and on the road and fooling around and things, and I just was over my head with being a parent, I think.
I want you to sing another song for us, if that's okay. And this is a song that I think you wrote after your breakup with Suzzy Roach. And it's called Unhappy Anniversary. It's a great song. Would you just do some of it for us?
Sure.
Unhappy anniversary, it's 1 year since we split. I walk and talk and get around, lie down, stand up and sit. I eat and drink and smoke and sleep and live a little bit. Unhappy anniversary, it's 1 year since we split. Unhappy anniversary, it's 10 years since we met. There is no need to remind me, no way I could forget. We fell in love, then we fell out. Both times there was no net. Unhappy anniversary, it's 10 years since we met.
That's Loudon Wainwright performing in the studio. Thank you for doing that. You know, we mentioned that some of your patterns, like, you know, having relationships with other women while you were, you know, married or raising a child with someone who you were in a long-term relationship with. And you realized that at some point you were repeating some of the behavior that your father had followed. Did you see his life differently when you realized that your life was in some ways an echo of some of his behavior?
Well, it's funny, and one of the things I write about in the book is about this trip to Australia that we took. I think it was probably the two of us. I went to Australia for the first time in 1982, and they threw in an extra plane ticket. And so my father, who had always wanted to go to Australia, came with me, and he was a new father. I have a half-sister called Anna Wainwright, Anna Faye Wainwright. And, of course, he had four kids, me and my siblings, from his other marriage. So we were a couple of guys out on the road with split up families, and now he had quit drinking at that point, so it wasn't like we were sitting around getting smashed every night. But there was a feeling again of that we're a little bit like the same person, or there are a lot of similarities. And I mean, I don't know if that answers your question in any way, but does it?
I guess part of my question is, when you re-examined his life through the lens of your adult life.
Yeah.
Did you have more sympathy for him, or were you equally angry at him and at yourself?
Well, I know that I have a lot. I have more sympathy for him now, and that's just because I'm older, and I've lived a while. I don't feel like I'm angry at my father at all anymore. Mm-hmm. I can appreciate. He was a creative guy. He wrote beautifully these columns he wrote in Life magazine, some of which are included in my book. He was a beautiful, elegant writer, I thought. And his dream was to write books, you know, like most writers. He wanted to write short stories and novels. He did have a few short stories when he was a very young man in The New Yorker. But because he had kids really quickly, he had to go out and earn a living. And he got hired at Life magazine, and he worked there for his entire life. And so his dream had been deferred. So I think I understand, you know, that was very painful and difficult for him. And I can I can appreciate how that could have informed some of his behavior.
So several of your children were not planned. They were surprises.
Yeah.
And now they're adults.
Yeah.
And it must be so, I don't have children, but it must be so interesting to have watched children who you didn't expect to have become not only born, but then like become full people, and to see what that moment in your life led to.
Yeah. No, I have four kids and they're all formidable. Three of them are singers and talented and songwriters and very talented. Rufus and Martha and Lucy are in the business and doing well in their own particular and interesting ways. And Lexi is just out of college. And yeah, they're all powerful, complicated, swinging kids.
So can you give us some sense of your relationship with them now that you're all adults?
What day is it? Well, it fluctuates. Rufus is pissed off at me now, so we won't talk for a while. But we have these things, you know, and Rufus and Martha, at any rate, like to write songs about our relationship. But this stuff blows over, too. I mean, we, at the beginning of the year, we all went on this Kiamo songwriter cruise thing as the Wainwright family. And we all sang together and were on this boat together and had a ball. We do great when we're on stage together. It's around that Thanksgiving table that's where the trouble starts.
Loudon Wainwright, it's always great to have you on the show. This was really special. Thank you so much and congratulations on your book.
Oh, thanks. I always love talking to you, Terry.
Loudon Wainwright's new memoir is called Liner Notes. Jerry Seinfeld became the biggest TV name to sign with Netflix when he agreed to star in a pair of comedy specials for the streaming service. The first of them, called Jerry Before Seinfeld, premiered this week, and our TV critic David Bianculli found it to be a delightfully well-crafted surprise.
On television, Jerry Seinfeld not only has been astoundingly successful, he's been amazingly consistent in pursuing and presenting his particular comic vision. He doesn't do big shows or specials about grand ideas and giant themes. He does narrowly focused TV programs about specific concepts. Then, within those narrow confines, finds humor, honesty, sometimes even art. With Larry David, he created the mega-hit NBC sitcom Seinfeld, commonly and aptly described as a show about nothing. After that, Seinfeld created a series for Sony's streaming service, Crackle, which is brilliant in both its narrow focus and its perfect execution. It's called Comedians in Cars Getting Coffee. It's exactly what the title suggests, and it's now in its 9th season. For Netflix, Jerry Seinfeld begins with another intentionally small-scale concept. It's called Jerry Before Seinfeld, and it's all about his comedy roots. He starts with Johnny Carson introducing him on The Tonight Show in 1981, then flashes back to the time, several years before that, when he decided to give stand-up comedy a try. He even tells that story from the specific place in New York City where he first had that thought. And for the record, it's on a ground-level shop window ledge at the corner of Madison and East 58th Street.
Next guest is a young comedian who's making his very first appearance on The Tonight Show. He's originally from New York City. He's worked a lot of small clubs, both in New York and Los Angeles. Would you welcome him, please? Jerry Seinfeld.
In the mid-70s in New York, there were only two places you could even see new comedians. A stand-up comedian was just a novelty act. They'd have one in front of a singer or a rock band, and just to be that was the most glorious dream of my life. That's all I wanted. And it's funny, but I was actually sitting on a ledge when I decided to make that leap. Right here. This is the exact spot.
Then, as part of this autobiographical retracing of his past, Seinfeld returns to New York's Comic Strip, the comedy club where he became a regular in the summer of 1976. The club is retrofitted to look like it did back then, so Seinfeld performs in front of a red brick wall, happy to tell some old jokes. So old that he includes one of the jokes from his original comic strip audition.
And I only had one joke that worked, which I'm going to do for you right now. And if you ever think yourself that you might want to someday do comedy, this is not the way you do it. Don't ever say, I'm going to tell you a joke now. So I'm left-handed. Left-handed people do not like that the word left is so often associated with negative things. To left feet, left-handed compliment. What are we having for dinner? Leftovers. You go to a party, there's nobody there. Where'd everybody go? They left. That was it. That was my first joke.
But in addition to recycling old material, Seinfeld puts his whole comic life into perspective. Back at the comic strip, Seinfeld recalls the first time at that club that the audience for his act included his parents.
No, one of the big nights that I had here was my parents coming to see me do my show, because I had never, for whatever reason, I was very embarrassed around my parents to show them this part of my personality. So when I started doing this, it was, you know, a little strange to them. You know, when I told them I think I want to be a comedian, and they went, okay. You know, you've never done anything funny. And so I eventually brought them here, and they sat right there. And I was so nervous that night because I was showing them this whole side of myself. It was like my little gay closet moment, you know, where I had to say, Mom, Dad, I don't know how to tell you this, but I'm a funny person. And I don't want to be ashamed of it anymore. And I want to lead a funny lifestyle now.
This special, Jerry Before Seinfeld, works so well for the exact same reason Comedians in Cars Getting Coffee does. It knows exactly what it wants to do, never wavers, delivers precisely what it promises, makes you laugh a lot, then runs the closing credits long before you think of getting bored. The personal touches added, like the home movies and the visit to the outside of Jerry's childhood home, are nice and smart grace notes. But Jerry Before Seinfeld doesn't need them, really. It's the best kind of minimalist comedy television. Just a comic, a mic, a stage, and an audience. Jerry Seinfeld has been doing it for more than 40 years now. And in his new Netflix special, he reveals how he started and demonstrates, once again, just how good he's gotten.
David Bianculli teaches TV and film history at Rowan University. Jerry Before Seinfeld is streaming now on Netflix. Coming up, Ken Burns and Lynn Novick talk about their new PBS documentary series, The Vietnam War. This is Fresh Air Weekend.
Support for NPR comes from this station and from Rhodes Scholar, a nonprofit committed to inspiring adults to learn, discover, and travel on learning adventures in North America and around the world. Information available at roadscholar.org. And from the Union of Concerned Scientists, putting rigorous, independent science to work for a healthy planet and a safer world. More at ucsusa.org.
This is Fresh Air Weekend. I'm Terry Gross. The new 10-part PBS series, The Vietnam War, has revelations for those who lived through the war and those born after. There's footage from Vietnam that was never publicly seen before, and stories never told on film before. The story of the war is told from multiple perspectives, with the help of interviews with American, as well as South and North Vietnamese people who fought in it, as well as Americans who protested against it. My guests, Ken Burns and Lynn Novick, are the creators of the series. They've been working together since Burns' PBS series, The Civil War. They also collaborated on the PBS series about World War II, baseball, and Prohibition. The new series describes America's involvement in Vietnam as having begun in secrecy and ended 30 years later in failure in 1975. Ken Burns, Lynn Novick, welcome to Fresh Air, and congratulations on this series. You know, there's been no shortage of media about Vietnam, reporting, analysis, books, both fiction and nonfiction, documentaries, feature films, even a former PBS series from 1983 called Vietnam, A Television History. So why did you feel the need to do another massive history of the war?
Lynn and I were finishing our series on the history of the Second World War in late 2006, and I just turned to her, and in some ways, as we could see the light at the end of the tunnel of the Second World War sort of looming before us on the road of history, was what we think is the most important event in American history since the Second World War, which was Vietnam. And so I just said, Vietnam, we have to do Vietnam. And she said, what part? I said, all of it. And we kind of both gulped together, joined arms, knowing it would be a decade-long commitment that would haunt our days and our nights.
I think one of the most remarkable things about the series is the multiple perspectives. You have the perspective of American soldiers, of soldiers who were held POW. You have the perspective of South Vietnamese fighters and civilians, and the perspective of North Vietnamese fighters. And I think that's a perspective that has rarely been heard before. Americans in Vietnam thought of themselves as fighting the communist threat. What were the North Vietnamese fighting for? What did they see themselves as fighting for?
Well, on one level, they were fighting for the unification of their country. Two, they didn't really recognize South Vietnam as a legitimate country, and they felt that Vietnam was one country. They were fighting, they were inspired by their great leader, Ho Chi Minh, to the idea that they had to be an independent country, and they viewed the South Vietnamese as being puppets of the Americans, who they saw as imperialists. That's sort of the official Communist Party narrative that really did inspire people to fight. But there was also a sense of manifest destiny in a way. One of our interviewees said this the other day, and it really stuck with us, that there was this sense that the Vietnamese in the North felt they were destined to control the entire country. And so that was a very powerful and resonant message, communicated extremely powerfully and simply by Ho Chi Minh and the people around him in a way that ordinary people could understand. And there was, you know, they were inspired with the idea that they would sacrifice to the last person, if necessary, to achieve this goal.
And my impression is they also fought because they were forced to. They had no choice.
Right. Well, so there was a draft, mandatory conscription. That certainly meant that everybody had to serve. And also, once America got deeply involved in the war, we were bombing North Vietnam. And so that was their very direct and up-close and personal motivation, that they felt that to protect their homeland, they had to stop the war, and the way to stop the war was to liberate their country. So they felt they had to go south to protect their families in the north as well. And there was a tremendous amount of resentment about what was being done from the air to the North Vietnamese people.
So let's talk about the Tet Offensive and how you portray that in the film. And let me start by asking you, Ken, would you describe what the Tet Offensive was and what its importance was as a turning point in the Vietnam War?
It's a hugely important moment. It is an attempt by the dominant figure in the Politburo, the First Party Secretary Lê Duẩn, to continue his aggressive tendencies and to launch a massive assault all across South Vietnam in scores and scores and scores of places, from provincial capitals and big cities like Saigon and Da Nang and Hue, but also to outposts. It was launched in the end of January 1968. It had been planned for months, and this thing went down. And it was a huge thing. We had intelligence about it, but misread it. Thought it was essentially an attempt to overrun our base in the northern part of South Vietnam called Khe San. There'd been a lot of fighting around there. There would be continued to be fighting. But what it was an attempt on the part of Lê Duẩn to sort of trigger the end of things. And he hoped that not only would they attack and be successful militarily, but that the ARVN, the Army of South Vietnam, would give up and come over to their side or surrender, and that, most important to him, that the people oppressed by the puppet regime of the South Vietnamese would rise up against their oppressors and join the revolution. None of it happened. It was a failure across the board in every single place they attacked, though it was in fact a catastrophic military defeat for the North and for the Viet Cong. They suffered losses, dead, not just casualties, in the tens of thousands. They could not replace them immediately. But the thing was, it was a huge public relations victory for them, because we had not been quite frank and honest and transparent with the American people. We hadn't been so for years. And so what we saw about the Tet Offensive on our television sets, what the reporters brought back and later tried to digest for us, a series of just startling images, contradicted the sense that there was light at the end of the tunnel, that we were doing well. Our leaders had been saying, we're winning this war, we're doing that. And everything that the Tet Offensive revealed in pictures suggested the exact opposite.
So during the Tet Offensive, the American embassy in Saigon is attacked. And you actually have footage of the attack, of that chaos. Would you describe some of what we're seeing in that footage?
It is unbelievable. First of all, 19 sappers blow a hole in the embassy compound, and there is graphic footage of dead MPs, dead Americans, but also dead enemy who have been shot brutally, and ongoing pitch battles. You can see what we presume are CIA agents as well as MPs as well as other regular soldiers trying to contain this chaos, all narrated by news people, and it is just an amazing thing. But it is so inherently chaotic that that chaos is communicated to the American people, and that chaos is so devastating for sort of collectively for the American public to absorb. It's filled with brutal images, the assassination on the streets right there by the head of the National Police of a suspected North Vietnamese spy.
Let me stop you right there, because that's one of the most famous photos from the war. That's a defining photo. It was taken February 1st, 1968. Describe what's happening in that photo.
This is a devastating image taken by Eddie Adams of the Associated Press. The head of the South Vietnamese National Police, General Luan, is basically with a scrum of other officers, and they have a Viet Cong operative who they've captured. And essentially, General Luan assassinates him on the streets of Saigon in broad daylight, with this photographer watching and NBC cameras rolling.
The South Vietnamese chief of National Police just puts a gun to the suspected Viet Cong officer's head and shoots him right in the head,
right,
and executes him right on the street. And we see it.
Yeah.
I remember the still photo. Was the footage actually shown on TV too?
Yes, and we were very, very careful, and we have to give some credit here, because this was extraordinarily complicated to find out exactly what was shown on television. NBC does not ordinarily license that footage for obvious reasons, and they would only let us license it if we would show what was actually shown on television. So our producer, Sarah Botstein, and her team spent a lot of time working back and forth with NBC to determine exactly to the frame what was shown, and not a frame longer or shorter. And that is what we put in the film. It was only shown once on television. It has then been used in a few other documentary films, but usually out of context, so it's not explained what's happening. And, you know, the context is important. We interviewed a North Vietnamese spy who had infiltrated the South several years before, and he describes that they had assassination squads that were going around trying to assassinate the Prime Minister of South Vietnam and
the North Vietnamese had assassination squads.
Yes, they did, and the Viet Cong. So there were assassinations and retaliations and atrocities going on in the streets of Saigon during the Tet Offensive on both sides. This is the one that was captured on film, and with this incredibly powerful photograph where it's the moment of impact of the bullet in this man's head and he's about to die. And that photograph was on front pages of newspapers around the world and was shocking and devastating and, you know, kind of makes everybody who saw it complicit in this act in a way that you're part of it, it's happening and you're there.
Yeah, I don't think Americans had seen anything like this where somebody is executed on the street. They're not taken prisoner. They're not interrogated.
Right.
They're just executed on the street by our team, by the South Vietnamese. And I think it made a lot of Americans question, who are we supporting?
That's right. It's a tough thing for human beings to understand that this is one of the activities that we participate in. I think it was, for all of us, it comes down in many ways to a couple of images, you know, a girl on fire with napalm, a girl hovering over a friend at Kent State, and then this image, perhaps more than anything else, because it's accompanied by the startling footage and by some deep, deep-seated realization of not just the geopolitics of it, not just the domestic politics that is plowing us forward, though people are in private filled with doubts, but just the lack of humanity in it.
So, you know, of course, in this movie, in trying to get multiple perspectives, you have this perspective of soldiers, American soldiers who fought in the war. And you managed to work in the stories of soldiers who died and soldiers who survived. One of the stories that you tell through audio postcards. And this is the story of Michael Holmes, who was from the Ozarks. His parents ran the general store in his small town. And you have some of the audio postcards that they sent back and forth on tape. And so I want to play an excerpt of a postcard that the parents send to Michael and then one that he sends to them from Vietnam. And I should mention that this excerpt includes some of the narration by Peter Coyote.
In Williamsville, family and friends gathered to listen to Michael's reports from Vietnam and to fill him in on what was happening back home.
We're all down here at your dad and mother's tonight, and we thought we'd all say something for you, and you could hear our voice and feel like you're back home. And we're looking forward.
Hello, Mike. I've been doing a lot of squirrel hunting lately and killing quite a few. Well, the Ozarks really look beautiful this time of year. Looking forward to seeing you.
This is Jerry, Mike. I think Ricky and Carol broke up, Mike. Ricky, he's really prowling now.
Mike, this is Glenda. I got a boyfriend, and his name's Danny. And
Mike, this is Glenn. All these other boys have been talking about hunting. I'm going to talk about girls. Girls and fast cars. Gene Bilbrey got him a new Bonneville.
Michael, this is Mother. The picture you sent us was real good. It looked just like you. I even liked that mustache, and I didn't think I would. You know, we miss you a lot.
This is your dad talking. We think that you'll be okay. Just don't be nosing around where you don't have any business and get hold of a booby trap or something. It's about the end of this tape, so goodbye for now.
We burned down a whole lot of hooches today of these people who don't cooperate with us, you know? Yeah, I don't really understand it because if they are, you know, not VC, and we do that to them, you know, treat them bad, then they're going to turn VC. The Army does everything backwards.
That's Michael Holmes' family sending him a postcard from the Ozarks to Vietnam, and then Michael Holmes sending an audio postcard back from Vietnam to his family. So after he sends that audio postcard that we heard, he's injured when a bomb hits his vehicle and three of his buddies die in that blast.
He sends another audio postcard saying, "Don't worry about me, two more Purple Hearts and I might get out of the country altogether." And a couple of months later, he's killed. It's very moving to hear these audio postcards and then to find out what happened to him. Do you know how you got access to this?
Well, sometimes we have to look really hard to find something like this. This one sort of fell in our lap before we even really started active production. Ken and I were traveling around promoting the 10th Inning film, which came out in 2010. We had said, I think we were asked at a screening, "What's your next project?" And Ken said, "Vietnam." And a woman came up to us afterwards and said, "There's a family in my hometown whose son was killed in the war, and they have these audio tapes. Would you be interested?" And we said, "Yes, my God, that would be incredible." And so she put us in touch with Michael Holmes's cousins, who had these tape recordings. One of the things that's remarkable is the change in his voice, the sort of early optimism when he gets there. It's kind of fun. It's sort of an adventure. It's far away from home. It's not that bad. And then he begins to see what's going on in the war. And then after he's wounded, he sounds like a different person. Mm-hmm. And you can just imagine for his family getting those tapes what that must have been like.
I want to quote something that the media critic James Poniewozik wrote in the New York Times. This is in a review, a very positive review of your series, The Vietnam War. He wrote, "The saddest thing about this elegiac documentary may be the credit it extends its audience. The series The Vietnam War still holds out hope that we might learn from history after presenting 18 hours of evidence to the contrary."
I think it's a beautiful sentence, and I will hold to my optimism. I think history has made me an optimist, despite the fact that it shows you that human nature doesn't change, that the same venality is present, the same abstraction of war is present, the same greed is present. But so is also the same generosity and the same love. And war is human nature on steroids. And so it's an eminently studyable thing. And we assume it is just all negative. But in fact, the free electrons that war gives off in all the instances that I've tried to tackle it reveal as much about the positive sides of human nature. And maybe the reason why we... You know, none of us are getting out of this alive, Terry, and we could reasonably be assumed to be huddled in the fetal position, but we don't. We raise families, and we plant gardens, and we write symphonies, and we try to make films and talk about history, and maybe there's something that comes from that that sticks.
We spent a lot of time with the veterans in the film, and we were with one of them yesterday, Mike Keeney, and he has said often, and we have definitely learn from him a great deal. The soldiers know the lessons. The people who were there, they know what's like. They know what happened. They know the cost. It's the leaders. And it's hard to hold on to these lessons. We learned the lessons of Vietnam. We vowed not to fight another war like that. And we didn't for 25 years. And then we did. You have to keep on relearning it. It's not that they're not learned. It's just that they're hard to hold on to without that sort of visceral experience of it. You have to have lived through it in a way, maybe, because we do abstract it, as Ken is saying. It's so easy to just think about war as this game. And through telling the story, we hope to hold on to those lessons for another generation.
Ken Burns, Lynn Novick, thank you so much for talking with us.
Thank you.
Thank you so much.
Ken Burns and Lynn Novick are the creators of the 10-part documentary series The War in Vietnam, which is now being shown on PBS stations. Fresh Air Weekend is produced by Heidi Simon. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our technical director and engineer is Audrey Bentham. Our interviews and reviews are produced and edited by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, Roberta Shurrock, Sam Brigger, Lauren Krenzel, Teresa Madden, Mood Zaidi, and Thea Chaloner. Molly C.V. Nesper is our associate producer of online media. I'm Terry Gross.